passages of the Old Testament, right? The story of David and Goliath. So I hope you had an opportunity to read it a couple of times over the course of the week. We might read it again. One of the temptations when reading these stories, and especially this one in particular, because we've been trained to do this from a very young age, is to identify ourselves with one of the main characters. And I'd encourage you to hold off on that. And in the first instance, just read this story in close detail on its own. And then think about it in the context of where we are in 1 Samuel. So why don't we read it together? And then we'll talk about some things we saw last week and some things we notice as we read it this morning. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Socoh and Azekah and Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. And his shield-bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." We'll pause there. What should happen at this point? Well, everyone, so we should have a whole bunch of people volunteering from the Israelites, but who in particular? Of whom should we expect?
Well, the king.
The king. The king who's a head taller than everyone in Israel, right? No matter how tall this jerk is, right? The one who's proven himself a warrior, right? The one who leads Israel in battle, the one who slaughters oxen and sends them throughout the kingdom, saying, "If you don't come, we're going to do this to your oxen," right? We would expect this man to stand up and lead the armies of Israel and destroy this uncircumcised dog, right? As he's called later. But what happens instead? Verse 11. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. And Saul is singled out in that verse. I'm forgetting. I want you guys to see things without me telling you. So I'll read and then ask. Yes, Rose.
Do you think if David were already king, that as king he would have gone out to battle like himself, or would he have sent Joab? Because he's king and he has certain responsibilities, and kind of like, sorry for the comparison, but kind of like on Star Trek Next Generation, like the first mate's like, "No, you can't do that," to the captain at certain instances because he's got responsibilities and it's the first mate's job to make sure the captain's safe. So would it have been Joab's job rather than David's if David had been king? So does Saul have someone who maybe should have been saying, "No, it's my job to protect you, I'm going out"?
This is a good question, right? Does Saul have a captain or a first officer, so to speak, right? A lieutenant who should stand up and take this challenge on the king's behalf? A couple of things to say about that is, one, there's great emphasis on the Philistine's height, just as previously there's been great emphasis on Saul's height. And if anyone would step up and do this, based on what we read a couple of chapters ago, although that was like 6 months ago, we might expect that of Jonathan, who's shown such great initiative. And you kind of wonder why he's absent in this chapter. That is true, right? Is there someone who should have stepped forward so that Saul wouldn't? Or perhaps after Saul stepped forward, said, "No, I will go. We need our king." But I think in the details of the text, highlighting the Philistine's height, whereas Saul's height has been highlighted previously, and then singling out Saul here, I think there's a deliberate emphasis, not just on the fact that no one will come forward, but that not even our king, not even our king will go forward. That's a good question. Yeah. Later, as we get into David's reign, so much a part of his reign is a mention of and a focus on these powerful warriors that he attracted, the 3, the 30, and the rest. And so I think it would be more natural to see that once we get into David's reign, because that's a part of how he rules. Whereas we haven't seen that as much during Saul's reign. It's a bit of a surprise for Jonathan to show such initiative when it's always either been Saul or no one. But that's a good question. You would expect, just in terms of good generalship, that you wouldn't necessarily put the general at the head of the charge every single time. Yeah. Good. We'll pick back up at verse 12. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, named Jesse, who had 8 sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took his stand, morning and evening. And Jesse said to David his son, "Take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves, and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. Also, take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. See if your brothers are well, and bring some token from them." Now, Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took the provisions and went, as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard him. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." And David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine, that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in the same way, "So shall it be done to the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, "Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." And David said, "What have I done now? Was it not but a word?" And he turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way. And the people answered him again as before. When the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear, and he took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. and if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God. And David said, The Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, Go, and the Lord be with you. Then Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped his sword over his armor. And he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. Then David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. So David put them off. Then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistines. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then David said to the Philistine, You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Shaaraim as far as Gath and Ekron. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. As soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, As your soul lives, O king, I do not know. And the king said, Inquire whose son the boy is. And as soon as David returned from the striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, Whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. So what things do you notice? Good. So if you look at verses 24 through 27, where David's talking to them. Good. Have you seen this man? This is verse 25. Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel, and the king will do all this. The king will do all this stuff for him. Right? You're right. They're not concerned, or at least they don't mention here that he's defying the Lord. They're interested in him defying Israel and then all the stuff the king will do. if someone will come take care of this guy. Good. What other things do you all notice?
What stood out to me is David's confidence that God would deliver this monster into his hands.
David shows utter and complete confidence. Kind of like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when they go into the fiery furnace. Except on David's part, there's not even an "and if not." It's "I will go, and the Lord will do this." Now, great confidence that David shows. What else do you notice? Yeah. Yeah, so if you look at chapter 16, starting at verse 14 and following, "By the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a harmful spirit from the Lord tormented him." Right? And so he goes and looks all throughout Israel, and his servants provide a man, right? And in verse 18 it says, "One of the young men answered, 'Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite who is skillful in playing, a man of valor, a man of war.'" He's already there known as a man of war. "Prudent in speech and a man of good presence, and the Lord is with him. Therefore Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, 'Send me David, your son, who is with the sheep.'" And so Jesse sends him. Saul enters his service. And it says in verse 21, halfway through, "And Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer." So it seems then to be the case that there's a strong possibility, because David's not his armor bearer in chapter 17. And it tells us in verse 55, Saul asks Abner, "Whose son is this youth?" And Abner doesn't know. It was 17, verse 55. That we seem to have these chapters or these episodes narrated out of order. Now, what's the effect of reading them in that sequence, though? Saul seems clueless. He seems unable to fulfill his role as king. Right? He's slowly losing his grip. And David, who has entered Saul's service, right? Because we see him entering the king's service, and then we see him doing this, we see David rising in prominence in contrast to Saul, who's in this rapid spiral of decline. This is one of the things that makes perfect sense to us when we're reading novels or we're watching television shows. We can pick up on these clues and know, often because we get this little
24 hours earlier.
Right? But we're used to seeing things narrated for us out of sequence. And we're able to see the importance. And often there's a particular importance to the development of the plot in placing those things out of order.
So, I don't want to go back and reread it. So, are you saying that this is before David was anointed?
That's a good question. Is this necessarily before David is even anointed? Because chapter 16 contains two separate episodes, right? The first half of chapter 16 is David being anointed as king. The second half of chapter 16 is David entering Saul's service. And then chapter 17 as a whole is what we call David and Goliath. Right? It seems clear that chapter 17 was probably, right, if we were watching it live, so to speak, happened before chapter 16. The second half of chapter 16. But that doesn't necessarily mean it happens before the whole of chapter 16. But what the narrator's done for us is he's He's introduced David to us and introduced David as Saul's replacement. And now shows us a series of episodes that highlight why Saul is no longer fit. It's not just that he's twice disobeyed the Lord, but that even the character traits that he showed previously that seem to demonstrate that, you know, except for being maybe a little bit immoral, he's actually a good leader. Well, no, he's not, because he's losing his grip on these other things. So,
also maybe losing his grip on reality. He doesn't even, he's not thinking that he already knows this young man if it occurred before.
So he's losing his grip on his own emotional state. As he's tormented by this harmful spirit. He's losing his grip on the army as he now with them cowers in fear rather than he leads them. And he may be losing his grip on reality altogether in his inability to recognize David. And narrating things out of order gives that effect. Right? He's losing his marbles. Several at a time, by the look of things. What else do you notice? I'll put that up there. Losing his marbles. And it leaves it just a little bit unresolved as to how many marbles he's losing, how quickly. Ooh, yes. How specifically is Goliath killed? This is true. But what takes him down?
A stone to the head.
After which David cuts off his head. Let's push into that because there's more going on. I pointed you to a specific detail in the text that the ESV does not make clear last week. Do you all remember what that was?
The armor.
How specifically is Goliath's armor described?
Scale armor.
Several features of his armor, what it's made of, its weight, right? This is pretty fancy armor, but especially. And a detail that's not present in describing Saul's armor is that Goliath is wearing scale armor. So we've got a champion wearing scales whose head is crushed and then cut off. What does that bring to mind for you? Yeah. So Genesis 3:15... Right, we call it the Protoevangelium or the Protoevangelion, right? The first announcement of the gospel, where the Lord says to the serpent, right, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. Bruise or crush or strike, which is what we have here. We have a singular champion, a representative of the seed of the serpent, standing forth in serpent-like armor, defying the armies of the Lord, who's faced by a champion of Israel, whose head is crushed. This chapter is not about us facing our giants. If anything, it's about our inability to face our giants. And I think if we're meant to identify with anyone in the story, we're meant to identify with the cowering Israelites who can do nothing to deliver themselves, who need the Lord to put forward a champion, who are slowly beginning to see that they cannot trust in the leaders that they have chosen for themselves.
also think it's interesting that the king was willing to let this teenager,
like, okay, you've fought a lion or two in your day. Go fight. You. Good luck to you, right? Yeah. It's kind of the picture of the riled up teenager saying, let me at him. Just let me at him. And they're like, okay. Okay, here, try on my armor. See if it fits. Yep. What else? Right? So I think we can say, without spoiling anything, that 1 Samuel 17 is about Jesus. Right? It's not about us facing our giants. It's not about the length of time we spend carefully choosing our 5 smooth stones and what those stones are. Right? It's about Jesus. It's about the champion of the people of God, facing the devil and prevailing. But there's more there than just the scale armor and the situation with the champions to point us that direction. If you look at how David is treated throughout most of the chapter, before he's brought to Saul, and when he converses with Goliath, he is despised and rejected.
Ridicule.
He's an unlikely savior.
I apologize, and I didn't go back and review this, but it came to mind last week about all the other passages where the armor of God and the different people or images that were brought to bear. About the armor. Or armor in Scripture, not just the armor. Feet of clay versus, and I didn't go back and review all that. So.
Yeah,
I'll put the ball in your court.
All right. Yeah, there's so much more to think about. How does this connect to other passages about the armor of God? What's the significance of David going forth with no armor? Right. And relatively unarmed. Isn't it interesting that he uses Goliath's own weapon against him to finally slay him, right? Having struck him down with the stone, he slays him with Goliath's own sword and then takes Goliath's armor as booty.
To be able to see and breathe, yet the stone finds his forehead. I mean, just everything about it, I think, makes it the way the story is set and couched, the background of David, when you stop and think about it, the fact that it's pointing us to something well beyond just the details of that whole battle are pretty obvious. I wonder, too, if there's always significant in numbers, but the fact that this went on for 40 days, and it seems odd. I mean, I wouldn't from it been, all right, I gave you a day or two, you haven't sent anybody out, we're getting ready to wipe you out. fact that they continued this assault in mocking for 40 days. It was kind of odd.
I'm looking for the passage in John. You may be chapter 8.
Could be because of this that helmets were redesigned after this.
Yeah.
You see them in the piece right down the middle. Yeah. We didn't think that one all the way through.
I'm not finding the specific wording, but in John, the Pharisees want to press Jesus about not knowing where he is from. Right? And then the prophecies about the Christ in Matthew that are fulfilled, one that Matthew mentions that always leaves us scratching our head is, he will be called a Nazarene. Right? Again, trying to reckon where he's from. And one thing you notice is at the end of the chapter, here is this question about who David is and where he's from. And we're left with this uncertainty, and then we find out he's from this little backwater town. It's the son of Jesse the Bethlehemite. If we back up from it and think about a big picture, what's going on in Samuel at this point? We have these series of rises and demises, right? Early in the book, we have Eli, who's in decline as Samuel is on the rise. And then there's this tension between Samuel and Saul. As Saul is on the rise, does that mean Samuel is on the decline? And then over these four chapters, we have Saul's demise and David's rise. In chapter 15, right, Saul is rejected. In chapter 16a, Saul is replaced. And David is anointed. In 16b, Saul unravels. Whereas David is at court, he's been moved to what would be for a shepherd's son, certainly a position of prominence. And then in chapter 17, Saul cowers, whereas David acts a king. I have a lot of these kind of movements in the book of Samuel. We'll see how this plays out further over the next few chapters. And it might also leave us wondering whether eventually we'll start to see David go into decline over the course of the book, if this is a pattern that continues. So, Brett.
Yeah, Six asked me that David is still particularly reverential toward, respectful to Saul. I mean, he doesn't seem to be kind of tongue-in-cheek. He seems to still recognize that Saul is the current God-appointed leader.
Yes. Nowhere in this does David, in speech or in attitude, throw shade, so to speak, on Saul. The contrast in their actions is its own word of judgment, so to speak. But David remains respectful, and that will continue over the next several chapters, where we're clearly beyond a point where we know that David's been anointed and eventually Saul knows, right? And here we're not sure of the chronology of how these things played out. But as we move forward, we're clearly past this. David's been anointed. David's shown himself a king when Saul has so clearly not. And yet David continues in Saul's service for as long as Saul will have him. Even as he flees from Saul, he continues in that respectful attitude. He refuses to stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed, as he says in several places. It's been pointed out, I think rather cynically, although it is an interesting observation, that David also, as the Lord's anointed, would hardly want to set a precedent of stretching out one's hand against the Lord's anointed. So we should watch for those sorts of things as we read 1 Samuel also, not because we want to become cynical, but because we do want to be suspicious of assumptions that we bring to the text. Right? And this happens with 1 Samuel 17, right? How do we approach this text? And do we often think of ourselves as ones who should identify with the cowering Israelites? Not very flattering. There's a saying that Doug Servin used to have at RUF, going through different passages of Scripture with college students. He'd say, "You are not Jesus in this story." Right? And that's kind of what we want to do. We might never actually put it that way, but we want to be Jesus in this story. We want to be the one who lays out the zing in the telling of the parables, right? We want to be the one who stands up to face the giant, and We're not. All right, well, why don't we plan to move into chapter 18 next week? I'd encourage you to read it beforehand, but we'll read it together if you don't. Well, whether or not you do, actually. And we'll keep reflecting on these earlier things as well. And I don't want to not talk about 1 Samuel as we go, but again, what I really want to get out of it is to see us hone our skills in reading narrative. Awesome. We're done on time. How about that? All right, we'll let you go.